Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, Mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long arm of the law.
Got miles to go before we sleep.
Lawman is putting an end to my running, and I'm so far from my home.
We will not go gently. We're going to unleash hell here in December.
Oh, Mama, I can hear you a-crying. You're so scared and all alone.
Hey, somebody fix this guy's buckle. I don't know if you play football.
Coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.
Welcome to this installment of What's Hot. Chris Carter, Brian Yardo. A pleasure to have you join us here on this Wednesday evening. And I say it every week, we're just getting closer and closer to football time. Less than 90 days now until opening kickoff. And unfortunately, my NBA season's over. My Cavs lost yesterday. But now, hey, let's dial in. Let's focus more on football and more notably the Pittsburgh Steelers. And Chris, how you doing this evening, buddy? And I'm sure you're just excited as I am that we're just getting closer and closer to the start of the 2015 NFL season.
Oh yeah, man! I'm just as excited that the Warriors won. Finally kicked into the high gear. I thought they sorry, I had to deal with that. I did think they get to Game Seven, but I thought that the Cleveland, the Cavaliers just running on fumes. Thought it would catch up to them. But I am excited for our show. We got some lively debates coming up, and we're hoping that if you're listening live out there, you'll feel free to call into the show and join our debate.
Right, and we're going to start off with that. Call in, please, 347-850-8581. Again, that's 347-850-8581. The big question is, our Select a Steeler part of the show, portion of the show, where, you know, we give you a Steeler, and for one game, if you have to start this guy for one game to win one game, who are you picking? Last week it was Rod Woodson, Deion Sanders, and the other thing is, too, one of us will defend and debate the cause for one. So even though we're both self-proclaimed Steeler fans, we may have to pick a side of the opposition. So this week we've got Terry Bradshaw against Tom Brady, and as you know the resumes of both, Terry 4-0 in Super Bowls, Tom Brady has won 4 as well. In 6 tries, and actually Tom and Terry now, I believe now it's 2014, so Tom and Terry have now both played in 14 NFL seasons, so actually this is kind of a good time to debate both of their careers. So Chris will pick Terry, I'll pick Tom, and that debate will be near the end of our show at the bottom of the hour, as we're going to go from 9 p.m. Eastern time to 10 p.m. Eastern time. So again, if you want to chime in at any time in the show to discuss who you would have between the two, dial it again, 340-850-8581. We also have a bevy of other things to discuss. And the first thing that I wanted to get into, Chris, is Clipping Gathers. It came out earlier this week. Dale Gurdnick, one of our contributors to Behind the Steel Curtain, mentioned in an article yesterday that Gathers was in another scuffle with the Steelers offensive line. If you remember, he joined the team late last season to add some depth to the defensive line with Brett Kiesel getting injured and other injuries on the defensive line. So we picked up Gathers late. He got in a skirmish last season. Ramon Foster said specifically about the skirmish last year that Gathers was maybe playing a little too hard for a group that just played 96 snaps that previous Sunday. So, you know, Ramon Foster took offense to maybe how hard Gathers was coming at the line last year. And apparently, you know, yesterday in their practice, which was supposed to be a non-contact practice, Gathers pushed the Steelers lineman to the ground, and Foster took exception, and then Pouncey and other guys kind of joined the melee and pinned Gathers to the ground. And this is a quote from Marquise Pouncey from Gurdnick's article yesterday. We always have to stick up for each other as a team. As an offense, you compete, and as a defense, you compete. At the end of the day, you have to compete against others. It's competition. We don't go out there to patty cake. Things happen sometimes, and tempers get flared. So, with, and then, you know, to follow up with that, Mike Tomlin just said it's just part of football, and he said, you know, it's an opportunity to teach more than anything, and that's the way I'll approach it. So, with all those things being said, is it? Do you think it's just friendly fire, Chris? Do you think that this could be kind of a red flag, and there could be some issues going forward with Gethers, since this is now the second time he's had an altercation with the Steelers' offensive line?
Well, let's look at it this way, and this is where I agree with Tomlin, that this is just football. Gethers is not a starter. He's not Steve McClendon. He's not Cam Hayward. He's not a draft pick that we're really waiting to see what he does. He's a guy that he knows he has limited opportunities to show what he has. And that's that kind of guy who, and he knows that about himself, and he wants to take the initiative to show that he's tough, that he's gritty, that he can make the starting front seven unit. He's going to want to be chippy at every opportunity he gets to show that he's nasty and that the Steelers will want him. So that's going to be annoying to starters like Marquise, who's made four Pro Bowls in the 5 years that he's played, to have to, like, look, this is OTR, this is minicamp. We're not supposed to be hitting right now. We're not live right now. But Gethers is probably looking at it like, I need every chance to show that I'm nasty. And yeah, he should not be going full speed. If he is going full speed, you know, when you were a starter in high school, if you played football and you went up against guys like that, like freshmen trying to earn their spot in the team, you understood their mentality, but it was annoying. So naturally, people like Ramon Foster, who's been a starter for a few seasons, Marquise Pouncey, who's an All-Pro and one of the best linemen in the league, it's going to be annoying and it's going to get chippy. But I'm not too mad. I don't think it's a red flag. I think it's like, I think you need to sit down and get it. It's like, hey, you know, you can be aggressive. You can work on your craft, but just make sure that it doesn't result in injuring any of our starters, because then we will get rid of you. But I don't see it as a red flag. I just see that Gethers has got a nose to be. He's trying to prove his nastiness on his team.
I don't want to say it's a red flag. I think it could be a yellow flag, a caution flag, because, you know, I think a red flag is saying, hey, there's an issue right now. I don't know if I go that far, but I will say this. It seems like Gethers might have more of an ego kind of driven personality, because there was also another quote in Gerdnick's article. They asked Gethers, you know, where he was in the melee, and he said, let's put it this way, I wasn't at the bottom, on the bottom. So it kind of seems like he's got his own agenda out there, and, you know, I agree with you. You know, our defensive line is not solidified. I mean, you know, Tuitt had a nice rookie season. Obviously, we're going to expect more of him in year two. Cameron Hayward's kind of the one guy you could look at and say, okay, you know, he's the catalyst of our defensive line. But even Hayward is still, I think, evolving into that great player. He, by no stretch, is like a Casey Hampton or a Kiesel, where, you know, it's some, you know, year in, year out, you're getting that high quality, you know, all pro level play. I think Hayward's just entering that part of his career. So really, you know, Gethers, who is not a starter, there is a chance for him to potentially crack that line, but you're not going to do that by, you know, roughhousing the offensive line and going too hard non-contact drills. To me, that's kind of like, you know, somebody throwing somebody down in flag football. You know, the pick and choose when you're going to be aggressive. When somebody's not, you know, when an offensive lineman is going out to block and there's no thought in their minds that they're going to face a physical altercation, it's just kind of a non-contact drill, and a lineman ends up on the ground, then obviously there's a problem. And, you know, it just seems to me like, you know, it's becoming the Steelers' offensive line versus Gethers, and you don't want that. Obviously, it is football, so there's a little different kind of mentality that comes with football. You know, I coach cross-country at the prep level. You know, if guys didn't like each other, there's a problem in cross-country. Now, football is much different, where it's okay if there's a little animosity between the O-line and D-line. And like you said, Chris, if that creates a better environment for practice, a more competitive environment, I'm all for it, as long as it's done in the right atmospheres and right situations. And I just think, you know, if the reports are accurate and Gethers was going too hard and that warranted the Steelers offensive line to fight back, I'm not a fan of that. You know, I again, you know, it's about the team. It's not about one individual. And if Gethers hurts an offensive lineman, then which we'll get to later, I think is the strongest part of our team, then it's game on. And I just want to make sure it doesn't get to that point.
No, I entirely hear what you say. I don't want to see that either. But here's, again, my thing is, I can understand this guy's deep. This is his career. You know, he's not getting, when you're in that position, you don't know if you're going to get another phone call. And yeah, he should be.
Point.
If Tomlin tells him, you need to calm your butt down, then he needs to calm it down. But if Tomlin's saying it's just football, when I hear that from Tomlin, that tells me they're handling this internally, and he's telling the players what they need to know. Because like we've seen Marquise Pouncey, he's a rebel. He goes out. He's not afraid to say what he thinks. We've seen Tomlin on the sidelines say, Pouncey, look at me, look at me, look. He got his attention, got him out of whatever anger spat that he was in, and Pouncey listened to him, shut up, and went back and got his head back in the game. And Tomlin has that command over a player like Pouncey, who's one of the best linemen in football right now, especially interior linemen. I see if Tomlin's saying that, I'm okay with it. Now, if he says this is becoming a problem and Gethers, if he brings that out to the outside, then yeah, I'm like, okay, Gethers. But as long as that's the case, I'm not too mad at Gethers. I don't, if he ends up taking Pouncey out for a year to Castro style, then I'd be like, get this man out of here. But at this stage of the game, no, I am not too worried about this. Scraps happen all the time. Ike Taylor used to fight Antonio Brown all the time. And look at how they were on the sideline last year when Ike was hurt and he was always celebrating with Antonio Brown. So I think it's friendly. I think it's, it may not be so much friendly because Gethers is not really a part of the team yet. But I'm not too worried yet. I like a guy who has a mean streak.
Good points, Chris. One point I really like that you mentioned was that you got to remember this is a guy fighting for his career. So any chance he has to show his mettle, he's got to show it not. And that's something that I think a lot of people forget is that, these guys are always fighting for their jobs, especially someone that's not a starter. That's a good point. And, we'll keep it with the Steelers defense here and, to the secondary where, there's a lot of kind of, unknowns, really. I mean, we know with the linebacker position, there's a ton of them. You've got Timmons, you've got the first-round pick of this year, Bud Dupree, you've got 2013 first-round pick Jarvis Jones. You've got Arthur Motes from Buffalo now in his second season with the squad. I mean, there's so many, things and places that we can go with our linebackers. Secondary, lots of question marks. Obviously, William Gay's back. He had, I think, maybe you could argue was his best season as a pro last year. Led us with interceptions, had a couple key picks at critical times last season in big games to help us win the division. Shemurko Thomas was asked earlier this week about Steelers secondary, what it has to do to be a revered unit again. And he kind of said something to their guards, we've got to lay the lumber, which, that's going to be the quote that gets quoted by the media. That's that big home run quote that the media likes, they like to put in print. But he also mentioned, which I really liked about the quote, was that we have to become a good run-stopping unit again. We have to help out against the run. If you remember the 90s Steelers, Willie Williams, I mean, that's the tackle that helped win the 95 AFC title game. Third and short late in that game, Colts are still up by three. If they convert a first down, it's over. Lamont Warren has a wide-open hole, the Colts running back, and Willie just comes straight out of the right side and trips him and stops him. No gain. We get the ball back and score and ultimately win that game. And you look at Troy Polamalu, I mean, there's so many shots at him drumming across the line, tackling Joe Flacco. So I kind of like where his head's at. And Chris, I wanted to ask you, when you hear those comments, do you think it's just – one of those cliche quotes, or do you think that Thomas, there's a lot of actual, he understands the history of the Steelers, and then that is something that stopping the run, laying the lumber, that's something that the Steelers are actually, will try to focus on and implement into their defense next season.
Well, if I'm talking about knowing the history of the Steelers and the Steelers play, it really seems to me with a lot of the ways how a lot of the players stick around and they keep around in the program and they want there. They are taught the way of the Steelers, the history of the Steelers. Rod Woodson, we talked about this last week, he's quoted saying, Bell Buck's the greatest corner of all time. He didn't just get that just because, he might have just watched it again. I'm pretty sure, while he was there, he grew to appreciate. He probably had a relationship with Mel Blount. And the same thing goes for other players. They know about the history. And Joey Porter used to talk about how they used to always talk about the great Steelers of old and how they wanted to finally have a Super Bowl championship so that the city could say, oh, these guys are also champions. So these guys, they know their history, and Shemarco knows that the Steelers defense, when it's at its best, it's known for bringing the pain, and that's what he knows he can do. And that was the thing that you saw at him in Syracuse in college. He brought the pain, so he wants to be a part of that. And that goes exactly with the messaging that you saw from early last season. Early last season, when the defense was struggling to get stops on third down, and even the season before that. But I remember after the Panthers game, when they asked him, "What did you guys do better?" I think it was Ryan Shazier that they asked, or might have been another game, but I remember it was after a game, and they asked Ryan, said, what do you guys have to do better? And we have to force third and longs. That's a huge part of comes from stopping the run. And so that shows me that Shamarco Thomas is preaching the same message that Ryan Shazier is preaching when the media is asking him, which means that these young guys, they're in the school. They're in the University of what was LePau and now Butler. They're learning from these guys, and I like to see that. It makes me excited to see that these guys understand, you know, if you win first down and you make it second and nine, and you win second down and you make it third and eight, then it's a lot harder to convert than a third and two or a third and three or third four. It's more likely that your opponent is going to pass, which means that your blitzers can pin their ears back. They don't have to worry about necessarily setting the edge. They have to worry about getting to the quarterback. So those are things that I like to see because I think he does know the history. He knows the Steelers. The franchise is known for being a tough, defensive team. When it's at its best, it's at its nastiest. And Shamarco wants to be a part of that. And he also knows that's part of good football. If you're hitting and you're putting the fear of God in the wide receivers, they're going to be looking, turning their heads. I mean, Hines Ward made defenders turn his head. So, yeah, I think it's a great sign. He definitely knows the history. And it makes me all that much more excited because, you know, stopping the run is something that this team did not do a good enough job of last season and in recent season. And it starts up front, so maybe Shamarco won't be contributing as much to that because, you know, Troy did that a lot, but Troy was also, you know, one of the greatest safeties that ever played the game. But, you know, I'm excited. I think I'm excited because they're on the same point of messaging. They got to stop the run early, and they got to force their opponents to the situations where you know they got to pass, and that way you can limit their options better.
I agree. I also want us to be a smart secondary because, again, you know, going back to the history, you know, Rod Woodson was smart. Mike Wagner, Donnie Shell, smart players. Carnell Lake, smart players. You know, obviously Paul Molly, smart player. Darren Perry, smart player that could read defenses, that could disguise defenses appropriately, that knew, that studied film. I mean, one thing that I think that, you know, the players, I mean, they're going to get coached up. I mean, obviously, you know, the Steelers secondary, that's the big question we're going into the season. And really, you know, we've gotten kind of away in the past, or we've gotten by with not having the greatest secondaries. I mean, you look at, especially a cornerback. I mean, you would obviously say in the 90s even, outside of Rod Woodson, you know, cornerback was maybe one of our weaker positions. You know, especially in the late 90s, I mean, we went to the AFC title game with Donnell Wolford as one of our starting cornerbacks, you know, which, no knock on Donnell, he was a solid guy, but not an elite player, you know, ever. Washington, you know, after that, a very nice player, but it was never an elite cornerback. You know, it's essential now to have great cornerbacks because of where the league's going in terms of passing. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day just at my apartment complex, you know, a 3,000-yard season in the 90s was the benchmark of being a great passer. Now, 3,000 mm-hmm. It's average. I mean, that's
mandatory.
That's an average.
If you don't get 3,000 yards, you're bad.
Yeah, you're not a good quarterback. Yeah, you're right. Exactly right. And now it's like 5,000 is like the benchmark for an elite quarterback. I mean, it really is. I mean, 4,000 is like 3,000 used to be. And 5,000 is the way 4,000 used to be. So we have mm-hmm. to be good at stopping the pass, and hopefully our defensive line improves to the point, and linebackers improve to the point that they can do enough stopping the run so that our cornerbacks and our secondary can play back and be better against the pass. So, you know, it's to be determined how good our passing game or pass defense will be, but hopefully Shamarco Thomas, his actions match his words and what he's been saying to the media this past week. And when you look at some of the rankings and you know, it's mostly on offense, you know, that's kind of where this team is. And I like the piece you wrote earlier. I think it actually came out today, Chris, about that this could be, you think, Ben Roethlisberger's maybe greatest offensive unit he's had. And if you want to take a few minutes, this wasn't on our list of things to discuss, but if you want to take a few minutes to kind of elaborate on the article you wrote and why you think this could be the greatest offense that Big Ben is going to quarterback and now going into his 12th season.
So when you look, when I was thinking about this article, I was thinking, like, you know, I'd like to talk about how good we have it right now. And there's still a lot of question marks out there. We don't know that Martavis Bryant is going to continue to ascend the way he did his rookie season, or if Marcus Wheaton will. But we can look at what we have and what the how high our ceiling looks to be right now. So the thing is, I titled it the most complete offense Ben has ever had. And when I say complete, the point of that is that it's in all phases of the offense that I think that Ben is benefiting from. So I broke it down between four different components to the offense. One was the offensive line, one was the running back, the backfield, one was the receiving corps, and the other was the offensive coordinator he worked with. Now, he's had three offensive coordinators in his career, with Ken Wisenhunt, Bruce Arians, and Todd Haley. And a lot of the talk this week revolved around how his relationship with Haley's better, how Haley's trying to improve the offense. He wants to see better red zone conversion, and he said that mid this year, and you saw an improvement on that after he said that. When they were studying why they weren't succeeding in the red zone, they improved on that over the season. And that's been something that's ailed them for many years before he even got there. And one thing that I think that you're seeing more of, and I talked about this in the article, is that Haley is making Ben, or maybe not making Ben, but his system has allowed Ben to make quicker reads, make better pre-snap decisions, and get rid of the football faster. And that's something that is mandatory in this new NFL. You know, you got to be able to hit people quick. You got to be able to make the quick reads, and that's what the best quarterbacks do. And so Ben's going to have to be making those types of reads, and I think that Todd Haley helps him do it better than Bruce Arians, who was more comfortable with Ben sitting back, letting him make stuff up, and getting it out there. And part of the reason that happened so much in Ben's in Ben's career is because after his early seasons in 2004 and 2005 and partially 2006, his offensive line disappeared. And so when I talked about what was the best offensive line that he ever had, I said the 2005 offensive line, because it had three first-round picks in the interiors of Jeff Harding, who wasn't a Steelers first-round pick, but a first-round pick nonetheless, Alan Faneca and Kendall Simmons. And then you had Max Starks and Marvel Smith, two behemoths as tackles. They worked really well as a unit. They helped. They pushed people around when you needed to run, and they gave Roethlisberger protection and time. And when you look at this unit, there's not three first-rounders in the interior, but there's two, and they're two pretty doggone good ones. And Kelvin Beachum's really stepped up. You see a young group of guys. They seem to be talented. They seem to be gelling, and they have a nice high ceiling, and not as many old heads as they did on that line. So when you look at when I'm comparing all the units, you look at how the offensive line is younger. It's maybe not as good as the 2005 line, but the gap isn't too far. And then you look at the running back. We've never had something in Roethlisberger's tenure. We have not had a Le'Veon Bell. We had a fast Willie Parker. We had Menehould and Shipley, and we had an old Jerome Bettis. And then we had other guys that filled in now and then. But Le'Veon Bell is the full package. And by himself, I think that makes him the best option that Ben's ever had in his backfield automatically. And his supporting cast, you know, we don't have a Dan Kreider to block. But we, you know, Will Johnson seems to be a serviceable fullback tight end combo. But, you know, I think just Le'Veon Bell by himself gives him so much more of a weapon than he's ever had behind him. And then and you look at the receiving core, I mean, we talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago when we talked about who would be your, you know, who's the best receiving core of the Steelers' history if you had to pick a single season. And at least in Ben's tenure, I'd have to go with the 2009 Steelers when you saw Hines, Holmes, and Wallace as a rookie. And then you had Heath also as an option. And Heath had his second-best season that year. Both Hines and Holmes went over 1,000 yards. Actually, they both went over 1,100 yards. And Wallace had six touchdowns as a rookie, and that was the lowest touchdown total he had while he was a Steeler. So looking at
they didn't make the playoffs that season.
They didn't make the playoffs, but I think a huge part of that.
But right, but it wasn't to the fault of the offense, right?
Right. It was to the fault. Polamalu got hurt, and then you saw how that changed everything on defense.
Right.
But that was the first season
right.
You saw Ben throw for 500 yards in the game, right? And this year,
right.
You got a unit that Antonio Brown is a better playmaking wide receiver than anyone in that unit. You could say Holmes is debatable, but Holmes never put up the numbers that Antonio Brown's putting up now. And with Martavis Bryant, you have a speedster, maybe not as fast as Wallace, but you got a guy, he's a burner. He can get behind the ball and he can go up and get the ball. Wheaton seems to be a good shifty, speedy, and possession receiver. And now you got this Sammy Kosu, and you still have a Heath Miller who's knowledgeable. So when I'm looking at all four step phases, the offensive line, the running back, the receivers, and the coordinator, I see a unit that's more complete than anything he's ever had. In 2005, when he had those running backs that he had and the line he had, all he really had was Hines Ward and Antoine Randall-L and Cedric Wilson and Nate Watson. I mean, those are nice, but they're not anything that what we got right now. And then in 2009, when he had that receiving core, who were his running backs? Willie Parker was on his way out if he wasn't out already. No, he was still there because he had a big game against the Saints that year. But Willie Parker was not the same athlete that he was. Rashard Mendenhall was not the answer yet. It was his second year. And the offensive line was atrocious at the time. And he still had Arians. And I think that the way that Haley's working his offense, and Ben said this week, guys believe in this new offense and in this offense of Haley's, and now he's had time to learn the system. I think this is the most complete opportunity he's had, and that, you know, for all those reasons I just listed, I think this is the best opportunity he's had to work in offense.
And I want to ask you this too, and actually when you alluded to the Steelers offense, NFL.com released the Steelers have the fifth best backfield in the NFL. I think the Eagles paced that list. Let me see who else was on there. The Saints were number four. The Steelers actually the number one ranked backfield in the NFL, according to NFL.com. The Eagles were number one with DeMarco Murray. Then it was Seahawks with Marshawn Lynch, Vikings with AP, which is kind of a question mark there. And the Saints backfield rounded out the top four. And then actually the Bengals right behind us at number six. And a couple other teams in the top ten the Steelers will face. The Chiefs are also on that list. And then the Bengals. But then that's really it. They really don't face any other elite units. The Bills and Chiefs were 7-8. The Packers were the fifth NFC team. They were number 9. And then the Texans with Arian Foster, number 10. So kind of to your point that the Ben's going to have arguably his best rushing attack with D'Angelo Williams, who, again, in 2008, he rushed for 1,500 yards and was a Pro Bowl running back. And then obviously Le'Veon Bell, who I think is second in the NFL over the last two seasons, total yards for scrimmage. And actually, in the top five is also Antonio Brown, the only receiver in the top five in total yards over the last two seasons, which is pretty remarkable. But I want to ask you, I think this is the best offensive line that Ben's had since his first two seasons in the league, and arguably could be his best offensive line ever. And you've got the perennial All-Pro Pouncey. He's entering his sixth year, so he's at the apex of his prime right now. Kelvin Beachum, you could echo that, and he's in his prime. Ramon Foster, mm-hmm. David DeCastro, Marcus Gilbert. And I think DeCastro is a rising star, and I've said this before on the show. I'd be absolutely stunned if this guy is not a Pro Bowler next season, if not an All-Pro player. I mean, what he does pulling out on the counter runs on the left side, you know, helping with Heath, helping springboard Le'Veon Bell. I mean, that's a dangerous, lethal running play. Would you agree that this could be Ben's best offensive line?
Well, you know, back a few years ago, I remember Neil Coulong, the great Neil Coulong of Beef Behind the Steel Curtain. he wrote an article called Too Big to Fail, and it was about how we've invested so many draft picks into our offensive line and early draft picks in our offensive line. And a lot of people immediately off of that article, I remember, were saying they need to produce. And Kevin Colbert in that span of time, he said, I'm not expecting these guys to gel right away. They're young. Offensive line is not easy. And to play with five guys together in a professional level, that takes time. But he said in time that they're going to find their star players in this, and they're going to be a pack of horses that are going to be unstoppable, or something to that effect. But that is something that he said a while ago, and now you're starting to see the gel coming. You're starting to see DeCastro being a nasty impact blocker. You're starting to see – well, you're continuing to see Marquise Pouncey being a factor every time. Ramon Foster, an undrafted player, being in there. The Kelvin Beach, seventh-round draft pick, but he's out there working in it, and he's ranked as the fifth-best offensive tackle in the by Pro Football Focus. I agree. This offensive line has the potential to be the best that Ben has ever had. And, you know, I think it's tough to go against when you had Faneca and Hardings on the inside, because those two guys were just they were both Mr. Consistency type players. Kendall Simmons was young at the time, and he was decent. And then you had, you know, in the outside, Marvell Smith and Max Starks. You loved both of those guys. So, you know, I'm not sure if the tackles will be as good as those two were, but the interior, I mean, it's exciting to see. And who knows? You know, we don't know what we're going to see. And I think it's a wait and see situation. But I do agree that they're the best group after that group, definitely, if they're not better. And if you're looking at this season, you got to be excited to see their ceiling and how high they can go.
Yeah, and God, I love that 0-4, 0-5 offensive line. I mean, that unit was great. It had youth. It had, I mean, Alec, who I think is kind of forgotten, is one of the greatest linemen in Steeler history. And I think a lot of it's just kind of how his career ended. You know, he won a new contract, wasn't going to get it. And you know, that last season in 07, you just kind of knew. I mean, it's always tough when you're watching a guy play out his contract and you know that's all he's doing. You know, he's not going to come back next season. And, you know, the way he ended obviously wasn't storybook like the way the bus did a few seasons before him. But you know, you can't argue Fanica's importance on that Super Bowl 40 championship team and what he was and what he meant for Ben during the first four or five seasons of Ben's career, you know, having number 66 on the offensive line along with Hardings, who, you know, was a Pro Bowler a couple of times with us near the end of his career. You know, he was a great center, too. And when you talk about Webster, Dawson, and now Pouncey, you know, hopefully people remember Hardings. You know, he was the starting center on one of the six Super Bowl championship Steeler offensive lines. And so, yeah, I agree. This could be, again, a very banner year for our offense, and one that it's amazing. You know, back in 2012, we had the number one defense in the NFL. We didn't make the playoffs. The reason why was our offense wasn't very good. Now it's kind of a 180, where our offense now, we know this offense could be, you know, up there. Could be up there with the 94 Niners, 96 Packers, 99 Rams, one of the most prolific offensive units in NFL history. I mean, I know reports last week and bleeding into this week, I've been reading articles on our website about Todd Haley and how people are, and Ed Bouchette of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. There's articles just coming out there every day that Martavis Bryant is going to have a breakout season, that AB is operating at the same level, if not a higher level, than ever before. So, you know, it's going to be an offense that's extremely exciting to watch. And, you know, it's one of those things, and I always say it when you look at Bradshaw and you look at Roethlisberger, you know, if the generation enjoyed Bradshaw, now Roethlisberger, enjoy your watching while you have them, because you only have them for a short period of time, and then you'll spend the rest of your lives saying, like my dad even now, he's always like, God, you know, I wish – especially in the fourth quarter, when we have a one possession lead and we're trying to bleed the clock, my dad always says, "God, I would kill for Jerome Bettis right now. You know, I would kill that Bettis in the game and just pick up those third downs and get up and have those demonstrative head shakes and while he prances back to the huddle." You know, to enjoy the offense that you're going to have, because it won't be around forever. And with that, really, here on What's Hot, and again, we encourage you to call in the show at 347-850-8581. We're going to dedicate the last, I don't know, 25 minutes of this show on quarterbacks. There was a list on NFL.com about where the Steelers rank all time when you just look at their top three quarterbacks in franchise history, so I'll get to that. I wrote a story today in response to this list.
I love your story. Keep talking. I loved it.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. And we're going to discuss that, because I should have put a poll where people could vote on that, because I feel like, actually, it's more controversial than I thought. I thought a lot more people would agree with me, which is okay. I welcome all comers and all opinions, but we're going to discuss that. And then last but not least, we're going to get to that select duo, which we alluded to at the start of the hour. You know, would you take Terry Bradshaw over Tom Brady? So we're going to for one game, so we'll discuss that. But we're going to start with the NFL.com rankings of the greatest franchises with quarterbacks of all time. And we only could pick three, which I think kind of handicaps the Steelers, because then you can't talk about Bobby Lane and there's other guys that get left out. But actually, the Browns are number 10, Otto Graham, Bernie, and Frank Ryan. So that's them. Dolphins, Marino, Greasy, and Tannehill, number 9. Number 8, Chargers with Fouts, Rivers, and John Hadle. And that's a great group, you know. The only thing that's really missing on that list is Super Bowl titles, but really the Chargers have an impressive trio of quarterbacks. The Steelers come in at 7 with Bradshaw, 1, right, obviously. Roethlisberger, 2, naturally. Number 3, Neil O'Donnell, kind of surprising.
My initial thought was
Cordell Stewart. you could go Bobby Lane. And the article actually just mentioned Bobby Lane, didn't even mention Cordell Stewart, but believe me, we'll get to that. 6 was the Rams, Van Brocklin. Natural choice, Kurt Warner, obviously. Bob Waterfield, I'd be lying if I told you anything about him. I know nothing about Bob Waterfield, I'm just going to be honest. So moving ahead. I mean, obviously he was good because they picked him over Mark Baldry, who had a decent career, was an all-pro, I think, at least once or twice. Redskins, Sam Baugh, Sonny Jurgensen and Theismann, which I thought was interesting because you left off two quarterbacks that helped win you Super Bowls, and Doug Williams and Mark Rippon. They were left
William.
Off the list. Niners, Montana Young and Brody, they didn't go Garcia and didn't go Kaepernick. Kind of surprising, but Brody was great in the 60s. Colts, this is pretty easy. Unitas, Manning, and Luck. And then Packers, mm-hmm. which I think is unquestionably number one, Starr, Rodgers, and Favre. Kind of surprised that the Cowboys were that far ahead of us, especially given that we have more Super Bowls than they do, and three quarterbacks that have played the Super Bowls, and they only have two. Romo's, Romo's even yet to get to an NFC title game. So I wanted your thoughts on the list, if you think the Steelers are right there and where they should be at seven, and kind of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I thought the list was weird. If you're going to base it on having three quarterbacks, it just seems weird to me because I think the teams that had two great – like, we're a sort of situation for the Steelers. You have two great quarterbacks, Terry Bradshaw, Ben Roethlisberger. Both are champions. Both are great leaders. They're gritty guys. You love them. And then, oh, but we're going to penalize you because you guys don't have a third great quarterback that won you. But meanwhile, these guys won more Super Bowls. Together, they've won more Super Bowls than any franchise has with all of their quarterbacks combined. So I thought it was a weird sort of list. You know, I agree the Packers should need to be up top, because they have that. If you're going to do that trio thing, I would take Terry Bradshaw over Favre or Starr. You know, Rodgers debatable, but I take him over both. The Colts definitely deserve the Unitas, Manning, and Luck is a great combo. The Cowboys, you're right. I mean, first of all, Staubach got beat up by Bradshaw. You know, he lost to him twice in the Super Bowl, I think other times in the regular season. So, if I'm taking one versus one, I'm taking Bradshaw. If I'm taking two versus two, I'd take Ben over Troy. And I think Troy's got more rings, but I think Ben will have more rings at the end of his career. And I could go Tony Romo over Neil O'Donnell. Whatever. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily put that group above the Steelers quarterback. I personally thought that the Niners needed to be higher than the Cowboys and even really the Colts.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Joe Montana, he's the GOAT. You know, when you're in this conversation, Joe Montana, sorry, put everyone away. The only people that could be mentioned with him are the elitist of the elite, and those are the guys with multiple Super Bowl rings and that have been known for being great leaders. And Steve Young behind him, he was the man, and I think they needed to be higher. But you're right, I was a little caught off guard by the whole not including Doug Williams, who's the only quarterback to ever throw five touchdowns in a half of a Super Bowl. Or was it a quarter? I can't even – I think it was a quarter, but I can't even remember.
It was a quarter, yeah. And 35 points in the second quarter, and four of those were touchdown passes.
Yeah, exactly. No one's ever done that. And Doug Williams, he should be mentioned with that. But either way, I think it was weird to do the three things. But it's one of those NFL.com lists, you know. They dictate so much. But I'm getting to your article. I completely agree with it. And there's a lot of numbskulls out there that think that, Cordell Stewart was this horrible quarterback. And I'm not saying Cordell Stewart was a great quarterback or even like a really good quarterback. But he was a heck of an athlete that made a lot of plays in a time where our offense was starting to wane. He had in 97. I mean, you saw him just step into the scene after 96. He made some plays, but I mean, Cordell never fully had like the complete confidence of Cowher. People say that Cowher called on them, but I mean, I remember in 2000, he was battling with Kent Graham for a quarterback. Like, Kent Graham, the guy was
right.
the worst quarterback I have ever seen. I would take Landry Jones over Kent Graham, and that's saying something. Like I was
he took
so
a sack
awful.
On the last play of the game against Cleveland in the opening week in 2000 when we were in field goal range. And I remember my dad thinking, we don't have anybody better than him. It was like, this is the depths of despair we have fallen in our quarterback hierarchy. Like, this is what we've got. You know,
right.
I agree with you.
And how could you know? I understand Cordell was not great, and he made a lot of mistakes in his time. But he wasn't like that, and that's what I'm saying. He never got the full chance to bloom. And in Jerome Bettis's book, he also said that he also never felt like that Cordell got the complete fair chance that he deserved. And the guy he got replaced by, Tommy Maddox, blew it up at first because nobody blitzed him when he came in. Every time people went up against the Steelers in 2002 when Cordell was initially, the game plan was to contain Cordell, make him throw into tight coverages, and you'll capitalize on his mistakes. So when Tommy Maddox comes in, he sits back in the pocket, and if you give him all day, he'll pick you apart. But as soon as teams started blitzing him, then all of a sudden he's doing horribly, and we're 6-10 the next season. He couldn't keep it together. So when people talk about who he got replaced by, yada yada, I never liked Tommy Maddox. I thought he was a joke of replacement for Cordell, and I think that Cordell, I would take Cordell over Neil O'Donnell. And I think maybe even with Cordell Stewart, they might have won. If he was a quarterback, maybe not the 95 version of Cordell Stewart, if it was like the 2001 version of Cordell Stewart. But if they had a guy with Cordell's talent, and it was his, that version of him in that offense, I think they beat the Cowboys. Because Neil O'Donnell, I mean, it was just, I was just watching Super Bowl 30 on NFL Network. He kept making mistakes. He missed open guys time and time again. Not just the two interceptions that closed out the game, but there were so many times that he just, yeah, thank you. There were so many times that he just kept making mistake after mistake after mistake, but no one drills him for that. No one's. I mean, people will say Neil O'Donnell lost the game, but they'll say, oh, Neil O'Donnell was better than Cordell Stewart. No, I completely agree with your article. Slash, I would take Slash over Neil O'Donnell just on his athleticism alone, the threat that he put into people's hearts. And if you get him the full complimented offense, they're that much like him, and that's him with a five wide group like that. And anybody could come in the backfield at any point in time, and you got to worry about speed all over the court. That's more of a danger to me than Neil O'Donnell, who will sit back and maybe pick you apart sometimes if he chooses to be accurate on that day. So I want to say I loved your article, and I do think that if you throw Cordell Stewart in there, you also got to bump the Steelers up at least over the Rams, and not just because of Cordell Stewart, but you know I would take Ben Roethlisberger and Terry Bradshaw over Kurt Warner at least.
All right, I appreciate your support there, especially because we're about to debate Brady versus Bradshaw. So I'm glad that we were on the same page with something going into our debate. But, you know, I guess one thing is I read some comments. And, again, if you have a different opinion, I embrace it, and I want to hear from you. You know, I think like we all do on BTSC, that's what makes Steeler Nation great is that we're a passionate fan base and we're not always going to agree with each other, but, you know, we're at least willing to listen. And somebody wrote that we won in spite of Cordell. And I couldn't disagree with more because that comment, because, you know, if you look back at the 97 season, you know, we were down to Baltimore 21-0 and Cordell had five touchdowns. We won by 8 points. You know, we, you know, we're losing to Jacksonville in the second game of the season. Cordell led us back and threw the game winning touchdown in overtime in that game and a very emotional victory, which enabled us to eventually win that division and then host the playoff games that we hosted. You know, we were down 21-7 to Denver, and then Cordell scores, you know, he has that another five touchdown game. You know, you know, we're down 8 points late to New England the following week, and he hits Yancey with a tightrope pass on 4th-and-7 on the sideline, then hits Bruner for the
Do you remember the Raiders game in 2000?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That was the one of my favorite times to watch. It wasn't a playoff season. They just missed it. They were 9-7. But that was
right.
That was the season you saw Kent Graham. I mean, Cordell Stewart's having to justify himself starting over Kent Graham. I mean, and in that game, they came out first drive. Cordell Stewart hits a strike and scores. And it looks like the Steelers and the Raiders at the time, this is the Rich Gannon Raiders. Like, they're tearing up the league. If they won, they clinched their playoff spots. If we lost, we have no chance at the playoffs. And Cordell Stewart comes out with a strike, and then the it was like second quarter, he gets hit, and he's hurt, and he has to go in the locker room. First play, Kent Grant comes in, throws a pick six to Eric Allen, runs it back, and from that, it just like from the rest of the first half, they just looked hapless. There was nothing going on with the Steelers' offense. And then I still remember to this day, I'm sitting there watching the TV at halftime just thinking like, man, we're not going to make the playoffs, Kent Grant sucks. You know, da da da. And then I get a call from my mother because I was like, what, 10? I was 11 at the time. And I get a call from my mother. She said, hey, I bet Giant Eagle right now, and all the cash registers are lighting up. Everyone's saying that Cordell's going back in. Is that true? And I guess it was heard over the radio before TV because then you see Cordell come out the tunnel and he led these guys back on a comeback to win a close game against those tough Raiders. And that was the last time the Raiders and the Steelers played at Three River Stadium. But, like, it's those moments. Anyone that says that the Steelers won in spite of Cordell, get out of here. You don't know what you're talking about. Yes, there were several games where the defense carried the team and won big games, but there was also several games where Cordell Stewart's athleticism and his quarterbacking skills were able to win the game. Not that Cordell Stewart was a great quarterback. We're not saying that, but we are saying that this man did have the talent to win.
And Cordell had the single-season record for completion percentage before Ben. So better than O'Donnell, better than Bradshaw, better than Brister,
yep.
better than Malone, better than Bobby Lane, better than anybody. And that has to mean something. The guy could find open receivers. And, you know, he had three different offensive coordinators. And when Shane Gilley left, that was tough. When Yancey Big Ben left, that was, you know, a crushing blow. And you know, the Steelers didn't replace with anybody. They just moved Charles Johnson, who was a third receiver or fourth receiver on the 95 team. They moved him to number one. He was fine. He had 1,000 yards, but he wasn't a number one receiver. And that's what Cordell had. And I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that 2000 Steelers team was one of my favorites because they were just sheer grit. That was a team that was kind of learning to be great. And a lot of that, I think, a lot of ways planted the seeds to what happened later in the 2000s because – that was the team that kind of brought the winning edge back. That was Joey Porter's breakout season. That was Casey Hampton. Well, no, I think Casey Hampton was a little later, but I think Kiesel, that was the first time. And Aaron Smith, that was the first time those guys were starting to play more. And, you know, that was back when Lee Flowers was kind of like the physical presence of the Steelers defense. If you remember that
game. I remember that. Lee Flowers, paper chance. I remember him. I liked him. Even in that AFC Championship game, if you remember 2001, Cordell Stewart didn't lose the game by himself like a lot of people say he did. The Patriots scored off of a lot of great special teams plays. They had a blocked field goal and a kick return or something like that. And at the same time, there were also several plays. If Joey Porter just catches a pick at like the 10-yard line, he walks into the end zone and it flips the game upside down. And who knows, they might have gone. I think that 2001 Steelers team would have beaten the tar out of that Rams team, even though the Rams team did lost anyway. I think that they would have put more of a licking on the Rams. I think they were just built to handle those guys a lot better than the Patriots were. And I think that the Rams defense would not have been able to contain a Cordell Stewart that was getting loose and jiggy with it. And if and buts were Kenny, every day would be Christmas. But when you're looking at it, everyone always points to – I mean, when Cordell was the quarterback, every time the Steelers lost, it was his fault. It was always – his fault. Even when he wasn't in the game, it was his fault. And that's something that I, to this day, that was one of the things that burned me, scarred me as a Steelers fan when growing up. I'm like, why do people hate him so much? But, you know, I do agree. There were several points in his career that the Steelers were going through learning phases. Charles Johnson, I remember him being our number one receiver. I used to try to win games the game day, with him as our leading receiver. Try that. That was really hard. But, you know, Joey Porter, I remember them talking in 2001 in that same game where they almost won it. The team wasn't ready. They didn't know what it meant to work to be a champion. They had bags packed in Heinz Field ready to go to the Super Bowl before the game began. They thought they had it won, you know, and they had to learn the hard way. It takes more than that.
You know, and we have to get to our final topic, so I can't tell. We could talk about this for an hour. The 97 team, this is a crazy stat. New England that season, they won 3 playoff games, won the Super Bowl. I want you to guess real quick how many offensive touchdowns they had in those 3 playoff games, Super Bowl included. How many offensive touchdowns do you think they had in those 3 total games?
What's your whole question again?
And the Patriots' 3 total playoff victories that season, including the Super Bowl, how many offensive touchdowns did they have?
3 total games. I'll say 4.
3.
Dang, I was close, though.
You were very close.
Man.
You were very, very close. Most people guess 3.
I remember
their
defense and special teams were so good at the time. And part of that was they knew it was coming. Hey.
Ty Law had a pick in Super Bowl 36. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And you know, 97, you know, I think the issue with that AFC title game was Cordell torched Denver in the regular season. Bettis also had 25 for 125. And, you know, and I think this was the reason why, and this is for another episode, you know, Bill Cowher's Hall of Fame candidacy, most people say he's not a Hall of Famer because he wasn't a great postseason coach. And until 2005, when really it was kind of like we're playing with house money, nobody expected to win, was just kind of go reckless abandon. But you know, before that, he wasn't a great playoff coach, had a losing record in the playoffs because he didn't make adjustments. He wasn't a good, you know, game-time coach. And I think, you know, in that 97 AFC title game, he said, all right, well, you know, we beat Denver playing this way in the regular season. We're going to beat them the same way. Denver dared Cordell to beat him throwing. Denver's rush defense, I don't know if this still holds serve, they were the worst rushing defense to ever win a Super Bowl. They allowed like 4.7 yards a carry that season. And Dorsey Levins had a nice game against them in the Super Bowl. But it was kind of the same thing in the Super Bowl where Green Bay said, oh, we'll beat you with Favre. We don't care about the running game. And that game, Bettis had 21 carries for 105, which seems like a lot of carries, but Bettis should have had 30 carries. And he was at that time, yeah. Bettis was 25 years old. He had some 30 carry games that season. Bettis should have got the ball a lot more because really, especially in the red zone, Denver just had six, they were nickel defenses all day. Like, hey, and Denver had a great secondary back then. Steve Atwater, Crockett,
Atwater was
you know, they had some guys back there. You know, Darren Gordon, who had a couple picks in one of their Super Bowls. So, you know, again, it's just one of those things where you got to look at everything surrounding the player, the situation, and Neil O'Donnell had a better situation around him in 94-95 than Cordell. And I think Cordell made the most of his situation with teams that weren't quite as strong. But
yes, indeed.
Nevertheless, let's get to our last topic, select the Steelers.
Hey.
It's going to be Terry Bradshaw versus Tom Brady. I'll make the argument for Brady, and then I'll let you make the argument for Bradshaw. To me, it's kind of the same thing as Bradshaw in the sense that they have four titles. Each of them has four rings. It's longevity. And to me, it's that Brady was – he's done it all. He won as a second-year player, his first year starting. He won in the height, you know, in his prime, in his late 20s. He's won despite his role players changing, his defenses changing, his personnel's changing, offensive coordinators leaving, coaching against him, then coming back to win with him. You know, really the only consistent he's had is Belichick. And again, I'm not a Tom Brady. I respect the heck out of him. You have to. And here my respect in this last Super Bowl, when his team was trailing by double digits late, it honestly kind of looked like his team was about to implode on him. Like, you got to remember, this is a young New England team. I know it's the Patriots. They've been around forever, but this is really a young team that doesn't have the players of old that won the first three Super Bowls in Tom's tenure. And late in that game, he converted a third down and long to Edelman and kind of willed them back. And that won my respect. And that's where he kind of joins Bradshaw in that, you know, he willed his teams to Super Bowl wins when they needed him to, when they weren't performing the way they should. To me, the difference between the two and why I give the nod to Brady is because of, you know, his consistent greatness, not and with different nucleuses. And it's not Bradshaw's fault, but he really only had one nucleus that he rolled with. You know, time and time again, while all the parts have changed, the receivers, Wes Welker, Randy Moss, David Givens, Deion Branch, no matter who's around them, and who's running the football behind him, you know, Corey Dillon, all those guys, Brady remains Tom Brady. And that consistent greatness in always putting his team in position to win titles is what makes him the better quarterback and the quarterback I'd want the quarterback one game. So I'll leave it up to you to make your case for the Blonde Bomber.
Well, if we're going for one game, you know, you got to go with that guy that, all I need is my boys, and I'm on the 1 foot line, and you hear the crowd roar, and your hair spring up on your back. That's what the Super Bowl does. You want that guy. You don't want Tom Brady who can play football. Come on now. Now, if we're talking about, can I have Tom Brady for one game, and he knows what the plays are coming because he did Spygate, or he has deflated football to his advantage? Yeah, sure. You know, he'll get that advantage. But Terry Bradshaw was the big game quarterback. If we're talking about winning one game, not putting up sit downs and then losing the Super Bowl, if we're talking about one game, I'm taking Terry Bradshaw. And anyone who calls me crazy is crazy. Because, you know, sure, yeah, he didn't have a great completion percentage. He didn't work with different guys that weren't really known in the NFL. He had two Hall of Fame receivers. He had a Holland Bay halfback, Hall of Fame center, yada, yada. And he had a great defense, you know, every year that he played. But despite all that, he played in an era where he was destroyed. I mean, in Super Bowl X, they had to take him out the game because he took a shot to the ear hole after he threw a brilliant touchdown pass to Lynn Swann. And it was a helmet-to-helmet. Dude led with his head and then fought with his hands, knocking him out. And there was no flag thrown. There was no pity for him. He was just, hey, that's football. Suck it up. If you breathe on Brady in just while he has the ball, it is a problem in today's NFL. So, you know, if we're talking about different eras, I think if you brought Terry Bradshaw out of this era and you gave him some time to work, he would be able to adapt, and he wouldn't have to worry about getting destroyed all the time. He would be able to take advantage of the rule change. And look, and notice how his style improved once the rules changed and allowed receivers to open up in the 70s because of the Mel Blount rule. His touchdowns increased, his overall play increased, and he called his own plays. He calls his own plays.
That was the X factor I was waiting for you to go with. I was waiting when you were going to drop that one.
That's one thing. And there was a brilliant article, I think it was last week, Aaron Rodgers was talking about that. And he said, people think that Peyton Manning calls his little plays. He doesn't. He switches off of plays that are called for him at the line of scrimmage based off of what he sees pre-snap, which is what all quarterbacks are supposed to do. But no one is the offensive coordinator that picks the plays as they go down the field. Now, you could be a no-huddle and do that and stuff, but Terry Bradshaw did that in the huddle, out the huddle, on the side of. That was his thing. He was the offensive coordinator, and he was the legendary Super Bowl quarterback that never lost the Super Bowl. I'm taking him every time over Tom Brady. And you know what? I think, and here's another point. The Titans that Terry Bradshaw had to go through measure up higher than the people that Tom Brady has had to beat. You know, he beat the. You know, he came out and they won. They won against the Rams, the greatest show on turf. But you know what? That Vikings team that they had to beat in that first Super Bowl, though it was a defensive struggle, Terry Bradshaw did throw a touchdown, and that was a team that if it wasn't for the teams that they went up against, they would have won a Super Bowl. That Vikings team was great. Fran Tarkenton was a beast. They had the Purple People Eaters. That's one of those teams that, you know, when they're talking about missing rings in the NFL Network top 10 list, what are the top 10 teams that never won a Super Bowl? Those Vikings teams are mentioned. The Dallas team,
right.
If it wasn't for Terry Bradshaw and the Steelers, the Cowboys would have like 7 Super Bowl rings, and who wouldn't hate that? Because they're already annoying when they talk about how they're America's team. Shoot, they would have had 7 rings. Roger Staubach would be the greatest quarterback that ever lived, and we'd be sitting here, man, I wish that we had. No, Terry Bradshaw was in there. He won. He won both those games. 2-time Super Bowl MVP. You know, and he went up against the LA Rams. They were a beast in their time, and he beat the Cowboys twice. And that's the Cowboys, one of the great teams that ever played football. Roger Staubach is one of the greatest quarterbacks that ever played football. So when you're talking about that, when Tom Brady goes up against TV, he beat Kurt Warner. Okay, you know that dude was hot for parts of his career. He came out of Arena League, blah blah blah. He beat Jake Delhomme. Who exactly? He beat Donovan McNabb. You know, McNabb was decent. You know, for Philly, he was one of their best quarterbacks. He just beat Russell Wilson, who I do think is a legit quarterback in today's NFL. But he also got spanked by Eli Manning twice. You know, I don't think that. You also got to consider the defenses he faced, but I'm sorry, Terry Bradshaw in those big games. If I want one game to win it all, Terry Bradshaw's my big game quarterback, man. He'll call the plays, he'll make the plays, and then he'll laugh about it afterwards with you and have a beer with you. But Tom Brady, he'll probably put on some Uggs and go cry about why he didn't have Spygate to help him out, or the footballs are a little too big for him to throw around today. So that's why I stand. Anyone that don't like me, hey, you can call in and tell me I'm stupid. I'm going Terry Bradshaw over Tom Brady every time.
And you know, Chris, as we wrap up the show, I was not going to put Brady. I said before the Super Bowl last year, I'll never put him in the conversation until he actually wills a team to win a Super Bowl. I won't put him in there because his first three, I know he led the game-winning drive, but what hard passes did he make in that last drive? And if they don't make it, they're going to overtime. So it wasn't like the game hung in the balance. You know, if they didn't convert, they lost. The second Super Bowl, kind of the same thing. This third Super Bowl, they had a double-digit lead late in the game. And really, they were never really in a threat to lose that game late. This Super Bowl, to me, you know, I would agree with you, Chris, that Bradshaw, he's on the Mount Rushmore of quarterbacks, to me, especially in the Super Bowl era. You know, he's definitely in the Mount Rushmore. You know, I would say unofficially,
well,
off the top of my head. That's for a different show. But it's the stats. You know it. It's the stats. It's the stats. But
yeah.
I would say that Brady now can be in that group because of Super Bowl 49. I mean, that kind of vindicated for me. Okay, you know, you can say what you want about this guy, but he kind of willed them to that win.
Yeah,
So
I'll
give you closing thoughts on this, Chris.
No, yeah, if you're listening, check out our iTunes. We're about to run out of time on the live. If you're listening now, you went and grabbed us on iTunes. We thank you for spending this hour with us, hour and some change. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Tom Brady, he did will this team. And my jokes about him wearing Uggs and Spygate, he is a great competitor. He's one of the greatest quarterbacks that I've had the privilege to see in my lifetime. I'm not slighting the guy to say that he sucks or anything like that. But I am saying that those are things that count against him. You got a question. There's an asterisk next to every Super Bowl win he got. And I know if you check out that trolling website that everyone talked about, Pure Cheating Cheats or something like that, they'll talk about how Bradshaw, I mean, steroids, those weren't anabolic steroids. Those are the normal steroids you take when you're injured and you need to recover. And those steroids he took then, I believe, are still legal to this day. And there's something that doctors use on their patients to help them. It's not dangerous steroids like and anabolic ones that are just muscle building and they end up injuring you for life. Because Terry Bradshaw looks pretty good for an old guy right now. Terry Bradshaw didn't cheat. He played within the game. He went out there and he was your traditional sling it quarterback. He didn't care who you had. He was throwing it deep. He believed in his guys. And I think if you put him versus Brady, and it's tough to say, if you gave them similar units, I think Bradshaw would have came out on top, especially if you allowed him to adapt to this day's NFL. Now, vice versa, if you put Tom Brady back in the old NFL, I think he would have really struggled. Because if you put, especially if it's pre-76 or 77, when they changed the rules, I think it was 78 actually, when they changed the rules because of the Mel Blunt rule, if you put him in that era, I mean, his quick throws wouldn't be nearly as effective. I think he would have had to make he would have had to take a lot more hits, and it would have changed who he is, because that's when he's at his worst. The Giants beat him both times because their pass rush was getting after him, and he was taking a licking. Now he gets up and fights back. He don't quit when he gets hit, unlike Tommy Maddox. But at the same time, that was something that really hindered him. Whereas Terry Bradshaw, he would throw a touchdown while getting hit and get up. So if we're talking those two guys, that's a big reason why I'm taking Bradshaw over Brady. Though Brady is one of the greatest that I've ever seen in this era. He definitely has that top notch. He does have four rings, although an asterisk is by all four of them. He definitely deserves to be in that top. And in the Super Bowl this year, he did a heck of a job bringing his guys back. They were down. They needed some big plays, and he helped make those plays. And then he had a big play from his defense to close out the game and get him the victory. But at the end of the day, Terry Bradshaw, he never lost the Super Bowl. When he was in it, he won it. And it wasn't like he needed the defense to save him every time. You know, in Super Bowl X, they did have a nice interception. I think with Glenn Edwards had the interception to close out the game. But
right.
With the Cowboys, they established a big lead. And the defense just, shut it down. And the defense didn't have to really shut them down. They said, you just have to catch up, and they couldn't. Same thing with the Rams and the Vikings. He threw that big touchdown pass that closed out the game. I'm going with the big game quarterback, the blonde bomber, the Terry Bradshaw, the 4-0 quarterback. The only other one is Joe Montana. I'm taking TB over New England's TB.
And one other thing, too, that I would say is, look at Terry Bradshaw's starting record at home in the playoffs. I mean, unofficially, I think they lost maybe twice. I think in 82 and I think 72 to the Dolphins, the undefeated Dolphins. There's only home playoff loss. Tom Brady's had a lot of home playoff losses in his career. I think most recently 2012 to the Ravens, they lost at home in the AFC Championship game. And really, if it wasn't for a drop pass, they lose to the Ravens in the 2011 NFC Championship game. 2010, they lose to a heavily underdog Jets team in the divisional round. The year before, they lose in the divisional round at home to the Ravens. So, Tom Brady, his team's been upset a lot at home in the postseason. And also, too, his undefeated team, he couldn't close the deal in a 7 against a 10-win Giants team.
And remember, remember those losses that Bradshaw took, the 72 Dolphins and the 72 Dolphins, and that he had Lynn Swann or John Stallworth, and they lost
right.
because of, I think, was it a fake punt? That's not all on him. In 76, they lost to the Raiders, and that's when their entire backfield was injured. And the Raiders, they were great that year. There was a reason that those two, and that was another reason Terry Bradshaw had to go to the 70s Raiders, one of the toughest teams that ever lived. Tom Brady, you know, he didn't have to go up against, you know, I think the closest thing that he had to go up against to like that was the Steelers. And he beat them sometimes, and they beat him, and he's beaten us in the playoffs. When you're talking about this, he went through those guys, and that was the team he lost to in 77. I forget who they lost to. Who did they lose to in 1977?
Denver in the first round.
That's right. I forgot all about Denver.
That was Orange Crush at Denver. That was a tough game. That was a tough game to a team, actually, that was pretty good. And they actually, their defense did well against Dallas in that Super Bowl. It was really, I mean, I think they had 8 turnovers in that Super Bowl, which mm-hmm. cost them. I mean, their offense was awful. So, still second ever most turnovers in Super Bowl history. So, but yeah, I mean, really in large. And then you look at the rest of Bradshaw's career. I mean, he wins the next two AFC title games he played. And I think what his AFC title game record was 4-2. I mean, if Super Bowl record was 4-0. I mean, his playoff record was I think he only had, 72, 73, 76. And then he didn't lose another, 77. He didn't lose another playoff game until 82. So he only lost 5 times in the playoffs. You know, so this is the guy that when he got to the playoffs and his team was at relevant health, he got into the promised land or very, very close. How many times did they get upset? Very rarely.
Mm-hmm. And again, he was calling his plays to get them there. Yeah, that adds to a whole other ball game of this guy wasn't stupid. As much as people wanted to play into that, he was a genius as far as picking the plays, running them, and getting the Steelers on the board. And I think when you consider all that, you know, I see why a lot of new age fans and even just Steeler hating fans, a lot of people don't give Terry Bradshaw the credit that he deserves for being as great as he was. They look back at stats, and that's why stats are a horrible way to determine a player by itself. You can't do that.
Right.
Bradshaw, when you look at if you're listening and you're listening on the thing, I'm bringing your favorite word, intangibles. If you're talking about the intangibles, Terry's got them all because he brought the big game atmosphere to it. He brought the he was always able to pull out the win of the Super Bowl. He was able to call his own plays. He was tough. He was gritty. And you know, there's a lot of things that I go for Terry. And he didn't wear Uggs, doggone it. You know, he was a man's man. Tom Brady, he's a girly man.
That's right. And you know, the other thing too about those two, with Terry, your girly man comment, I'm not gonna lie, I'm losing my train of thought. That was pretty funny. You know, and I agree with you. Statistics really isn't a way to measure it. But let me ask you real quick here. What's your Mount Rushmore of quarterbacks? Where would you, if you can only pick four, who are you going with? And let's
only pick
just for the sake of argument. I mean, let's go Super Bowl era because obviously Otto Graham, Sonny Jurgensen. I mean, you could, in my opinion, it's impossible to pick a top four. It really is. So for the sake of that, to kind of condense the question, we'll go Super Bowl era.
My top four. Well, Montana and Bradshaw, those are the mandatory two. And from there, man, it's tough. You want to say Unitas. I want to say him. He's a Pittsburgher. But, you know, if we're talking Super Bowl era, problem is, you know, he was elite, but he didn't lead him to a whole bunch of Super Bowl trophies. Man, if I'm picking up Mount Rushmore, those are my first two. Come back to me. I gotta put my story because I have many names I want to say, but if I had to pick two, it's tough to pick them. Who's your four? I'll come up with my second two after you say your four.
And honestly, Chris, this is just, and I make it pretty easy for mine. It's who I, you know, I guess with you got to go with the rings start. So automatically you put Brady there. You put Montana there, you put Bradshaw there. They have four, so they have all three have to be up there. And then it gets, like you said, it gets murky because if you're not really if you're just starting at Super Bowl era, you could say Star, you could say Unitas, but they were kind of at the tail end of their careers when Super Bowls were there. You know, Unitas won one in 70 when his career, he was really at that point the twilight of his career. Star was still good when he won those two. I don't think a lot of people are going to agree with me, and I don't blame you. I go Favre. He's four. He's four for me. And it's tough because Aikman won three, and I actually think Aikman's a lot to me like Bradshaw, where he – it's kind of like, you know, people say, well, he wasn't great because he had Irvin and Smith and that offensive line. It's kind of like, well, who gets the credit then? Because then when you mention, oh, well, Emmett was the great player, well, he had Aikman and Irvin. Well, someone has to take credit for it. You know, and sometimes, you know, players get the shaft because they play on great teams. So you know, their contributions to the greatness is overlooked. And that's what happens, I think, with Bradshaw along with his stats. But, you know, to me, I loved watching Favre play. You know, every time Favre played, I tried to watch him. And when the Vikings faced the Steelers in 09, that's one of my favorite, like, games I've ever watched. Because that was Favre. He made great plays. Adrian Peterson was out there doing his thing. And we beat that team.
Oh, God.
Because we were the reigning Super Bowl champions. And that was a fun game to watch.
Thank you, Lamar Woodley, for that, for his touchdown. But, yeah, that was the game that Adrian Peterson, Truck Williams game. I was like, oh, good Lord.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I didn't. I still hear about that hit. Oh, you remember that one time? He got Truck. Oh, that was 6 years ago. Yeah, okay. So, legit, I hear you for Favre. He's a respectable boy. He's one of the best that ever played. He's a gunslinger. You know, he resembles a lot like Ben. I wouldn't put Favre up there because he threw way too many interceptions for me. And he didn't get – again, it's different. If he did that and that was part of his style to get his team to four Super Bowls, that's great. But in so many big games, he faltered for me. That's why I can't put him at the very, very top. Even with that 2019, I mean, that team really should have gone to the Super Bowl. And I think him versus Manning would have been spectacular to watch that year. Even though Reeves versus Manning was a lot of fun, I think Favre versus Manning, that would have been – one for the ages, and that we'd still be talking about, like, man, you remember when these things went back and forth? I think that would have been so much fun. But if to finish my four, that's it. Bradshaw and Montana are my first automatic two. If I had to say two more, I'd put Brady in there. Yeah, I'd give him crap because he's a good man. And I say that being facetious. I got a lot of respect for the guy. He's an amazing competitor. And, you know, he's one of the baddest dudes that ever played the game. But Brady's got to be up there for all the things that he's done. And my four, and you could say that these dudes are black. I put Staubach up there. You know, Roger Staubach, the comeback captain. He won two Super Bowls, and the only reason he didn't win more was because Bradshaw was in the way, and the Steelers, and he went up against that Johnson team. And I think that without them, I mean, the Cowboys, they set a different tone in the 70s. And Staubach is revered much higher, and a lot of things that he did in that offense were just spectacular. When you go back and watch them, like, dang, this guy was ahead of his time. You know, Bradshaw was a bomber, and he was gritty, but Roger Staubach, if you put Roger Staubach in today's game, because he was doing a lot of things that you see today with the high speed, he was doing that then with the tougher rules. So, I mean, Staubach,
right.
I put him up there because I have a lot of respect for the way that he commanded his team, and he was your tradition. He was the ultimate cowboy before Troy Aikman. He was the ultimate representation of that franchise. You know, and you could say Emmitt Smith and Michael Irvin and yada yada yada, but he's the ultimate cowboy, and they're one of the greatest franchises in NFL history. So I put Staubach, I put Brady, I put Bradshaw, and I got Montana. That's my Mount Rushmore right there.
Man, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And on another show, I'd love to hear your, you know, I grew up arguing the top four running backs. That's something that you and I definitely have to do at some point. And you know, that might be the new next one for next week. It's like the Steelers. You know, we've been debating, you know, Franco, the bus, people we could compare them with. So that could be something that comes in a show very soon in the near future, maybe even next week. But that'll do it for this installment of What's Hot. Once again, Chris, it's a pleasure talking Steelers with you. Mari, looking forward to next week. And collaborate on for that show. Again, call in next week on the show if you're so inclined. And if you don't listen to the show live, the podcast, this podcast, will be published by our editor tomorrow on the website, and that's Jeff Hartman. So thanks, Jeff, for doing that for us and allowing us to do the show. Also, if you want to go on iTunes, click on the podcast portion of iTunes and then write the standard as standard, and you'll see the title for our show titled What's Hot. So once again, for Chris Carter, this is Brian DeArtis signing off. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you join us again next week. And as always, it's a great day to be a Steelers fan.